Hello, I'm Alice, and welcome to Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP membership communities and engagement team. A warning for listeners that this episode may contain some descriptions of war and conflict. In August 2021, the world watched as the Taliban executed an unchallenged takeover of Kabul, leading to Afghanistan once again living under Taliban rule. As citizens, vulnerable groups and allies evacuated the city, the BMA released a statement co-signed by the RCGP, fellow Royal Medical Colleges and governing bodies, condemning the oppression and danger being faced by Afghan women, in particular, female healthcare workers being banned from practicing medicine and medical students unable to continue their training. A few weeks before this recording took place, Russian military forces had invaded Ukraine, forcing a reported 1 million Ukrainians to evacuate to neighbouring countries. These wars highlight the adversity faced by countless doctors and clinicians displaced from their home countries, either through conflict or persecution, having to leave behind careers, family, and stability to restart in a foreign country. According to the BMA's latest figures, there are approximately 2,000 refugee doctors in the UK, and in the lead-up to Refugee Week on 20th of June, Team GP Perspectives will be releasing a special series of episodes focusing on refugee and displaced doctors, their voices, health needs as patients, and the organisations set up to support their retraining and settlement. In this episode, I'm honoured to be joined by two GPs and an aspiring doctor who will be sharing their experiences working with organisations which support displaced doctors hoping to retrain and join the UK medical workforce. If you could briefly introduce yourselves and your remit.
My name's Steve Nicholas. I retired as a GP about 10 years ago, having worked in practices in inner London, which were very diverse. And I now work as a volunteer with the Refugee Council in London.
Hi, I'm Marie Monaghan. I'm a GP working in Salford. For the past 2.5 years, I've also been working for Reach Northwest, which is an organisation based at Salford Royal Hospital. And we provide education and support to refugee and asylum seeking healthcare professionals to help them re-establish their careers in the UK.
Hi, I'm Molly. I am a final year medical student at Nottingham, and I am a co-founder of the Phoenix Project, which is a project set up to assist refugee and asylum seeker doctors retrain in the UK.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining me today. You've just mentioned the projects you're associated with, which we will cover in more detail later in the podcast. But my first question to you is, in your capacity working with these organisations, what are the main issues you observe asylum seeker and refugee healthcare professionals facing when they arrive in the UK?
Of course, yeah. I think you can think of the problems that they face in two separate areas. First of all, they'll be facing the same difficulties that any asylum seeker or refugee faces in terms of dealing with things like accommodation, finance, their immigration status, adapting to the new culture and language and the differences that they'll face on arrival in a new country. They'll also obviously be dealing with perhaps past traumas, ongoing traumas in terms of worry about what's happening back home, friends and family that they've left behind, and potentially physical and mental health problems as well. On the other side, they'll have the separate worry of how to re-establish their career and get back to work. And that's specifically what we're involved with at Reach Northwest, in helping them to re-establish their qualifications and gain GMC registration.
One of the major things is actually learning English to the high standard that you need for GMC registration. And some of them won't have any English at all when they arrive. So that can take 2 or 3 years. You've then got to re-qualify, which means taking a couple of exams, which are equivalent to really kind of final year medical school in terms of standard. And then actually finding a place in the NHS where you can begin your career safely with enough support. And I think people often underestimate just how different the NHS is from the kind of systems in which they will have worked and trained, and a completely different professional culture, which takes a long time to recognise and understand and begin to adapt to. And I think that's a process which actually takes 10 years, probably.
Has this been a similar experience for you at the Phoenix Project, Molly?
Well, I think it's been pretty well covered. I think on the financial element that has been mentioned is that also these exams cost really quite a lot of money. Although there are some subsidies available and financial help available, it still costs, I mean, I think it's about 1,400, 1,500 quid to fully really re-qualify, which is a huge amount of money. As we all know, asylum seekers are granted quite a small amount of money per week to live on. And then even looking past that, once someone's you kind of got refugee status, the likelihood that they'll be earning enough money to have that as spare cash is probably unlikely. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be able to just fork that out. Also, that's assuming that you've passed first time and with no kind of additional resources. I think also kind of navigating the system as well. I mean, as you said, I'm a final year medical student. I find it difficult enough to navigate how to apply for jobs, how the NHS works, how my salary's going to work. And like, I was born here, I've been at medical school here and schooling here. I think the information is generally quite unclear. And I think that that is like a really significant barrier to people re-qualifying here as well.
I'd like to ask you about the housing situation or environment some displaced doctors might be facing when they arrive in the UK. As they have no control over where they're placed, they might be living with strangers or other vulnerable people, either with their families or by themselves. And can this affect their studying, revision or training?
We've less so come across people in that specific situation, but a large majority of our participants are women who have families, and often in situations where they're in hotels or very, very small spaces with young children trying to revise, which is also not an issue kind of exclusive to this group. But I think that that burden of not having that space to be able to work and just get your head straight is incredibly challenging for people.
I think that's become even more of an issue during the pandemic. Obviously, in the past, we've been able to support our members to access sources of funding for childcare, for example, to allow them to come to class and study medicine. And obviously, since COVID, everybody's been stuck at home, potentially the whole family in one small room. And to attend Zoom classes or to study for exams in that kind of situation is really difficult.
That brings us nicely onto the next question, which is how do your organisations or charities support these doctors?
Yeah, absolutely. So Reach Northwest was established in 2003 at Salford Royal Hospital, and we accept refugee doctors and other healthcare professionals. We teach them English, so we help them to work towards the OET exam, which is the occupational English test that they need to provide evidence of their English competency for the GMC. They then move into clinical classes where we teach sort of a broad-based curriculum, really, about clinical topics and also professionalism and NHS culture, things that they will need in order to pass the clinical exams. It's a really interesting group to teach because everybody has such a wide range of different clinical experience and a different history. So we have some members who have barely finished their internship, only just graduated from medical school, and then have had to move to the UK, where we've others in the same class who may have a very long and specialised career in ophthalmology or paediatrics and are forced to come and go back to the beginning and learn a broad medical curriculum. So that can be a really challenging time. And then after we've gotten through their clinical exams, we would offer them a clinical placement of 3 months at Salford Royal Hospital, initially as an observer only. But the idea is that after their GMC registration comes through, then they can work and help on the wards, gain confidence and gain clinical experience to put on their CV to allow them to apply for jobs.
I co-founded the Phoenix Project with my friend Johnny Bowley in 2018 when we were second years. It initially just started off as us with a couple of people in kind of Nottingham Medical School Library, and then when the pandemic hit we realised that was no longer possible, so we moved on to online teaching. It's kind of enabled us to expand quite a lot, so we now have 5 branches across the country with over 80 volunteers who deliver between 25 and 35 hours of teaching a week. What we do predominantly is provide one-to-one teaching and assistance for the main qualification exam, so the occupational English test, and then part 2 of the PLAB. We also create resources for our participants to use, and we kind of try to use it as an opportunity to help familiarise people with the NHS and the professional culture here, and also to provide what we hope is quite a welcoming space to who we hope will be our future colleagues. We also provide financial assistance as well. We partially sponsor exams for our participants.
Yeah, I mean, we do very much the same as REACH does. We're very fortunate in that we're kind of quite well embedded into our local hospitals and Health Education England and our local GP. So what we've tried to do, at least pre-COVID, was to get doctors into a clinical environment as quickly as possible as healthcare assistants and phlebotomists. During COVID, we've been able to establish medical support worker posts in some of our local hospitals. So I think we've got something like 20 refugees in the Royal London Hospital at the moment. And that's a very good way of acculturating to medicine in the UK while you're still working for your exams. And then once people pass exams, we were then able to put them into observer posts where you're just a fly on the wall for a couple of months, beginning to see how the computer system works, how you filled in a prescription card. And then they can move on to special 6-month posts where they get a lot of supervision and specific education to kind of support them through that first really important transition into NHS work. Pre-COVID, we used to meet in a room in Stratford, and there would be two or three recently retired GPs or hospital doctors, and then as many refugee doctors as were free to turn up. And we would do very much the kind of thing that Marie was describing. But I think the really important thing that they get from us is actually the experience of being part of a peer group, so that they're actually relating to themselves as refugee doctors facing the same barriers, but also beginning to feel themselves as part of a new medical community. And actually, after maybe 5 or 10 years out of clinical practice, beginning to be able to feel like a doctor again, think like a doctor again, imagine themselves working. And also, I think, just feeling welcomed by their professional community. So I think the educational stuff we do is terribly, terribly important. But I think there's also something psychosocial that goes on, which is just as important.
Thank you for raising that, Stephen, because it is something I wanted to pick up on. I can imagine these social networks and groups are highly important, both emotionally and mentally, for these doctors. And aside from that, do you find mental health is something which needs to be often addressed?
Absolutely, yeah. So we have a dedicated pastoral care worker who provides that initial support. And for those members who we feel need sort of more intensive support, I suppose, we're fortunate enough to have volunteers, an ex-psychiatrist and a psychologist who we can link members to, and they will provide more one-to-one confidential psychological support for those members who need it. Obviously, we would signpost people to their own GP if needed, but we do have those resources available for people who need a bit of extra help.
One of the advantages of working with the Refugee Council is that you've got so much support around you, so that if people do hit legal problems, financial problems, or mental health problems, then there's a referral network that we can use. So we try to be very boundaried in what we do, so that if we identify psychological or family problems, we encourage people to seek help elsewhere, rather than trying to do what GPs are too tempted to do, which is try and sort it all out themselves. So I find it very, very reassuring that when I come across a refugee doctor who's very depressed, or whose family is trapped somewhere, or their marriage is breaking down, then at least I know that there are other sources of help that I can refer them on to. I think the other thing is that the well-established groups like Manchester and London and Cardiff, there's a tremendous resource of knowledge and experience. And I think when new people are getting involved, they sometimes aren't aware of some of the kind of legal complexities, and also the difficulty of people coming from countries where the medical training isn't quite, doesn't quite match up with what's expected here in the UK. And we've certainly found the General Medical Council incredibly helpful in moving heaven and earth, really, to try and establish that people are properly qualified doctors. And it can be a waste of resource, really, if you begin to work hard with somebody who actually is never going to be able to work in the UK because their medical qualifications aren't accepted. But obviously, people are coming with missing documents and those sorts of things. And the GMC, I don't know how they do it, but they manage to confirm the bona fides of people who've come from war-torn regions where the medical school no longer exists. So I'm very impressed with them. I think, Marie, you've probably had good experience of that as well.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, if you imagine somebody in that situation having to leave their home at short notice in an emergency, you're not necessarily going to think to pick up your paperwork and your degree certificate on the way out. And, you know, having to chase then, track down previous colleagues to get a certificate of good standing or to establish the evidence of what internship you've done, when and where, can be really difficult. But yeah, the GMC's refugee liaison officer does absolutely everything that she can to come up with alternative sources of evidence and different ways to prove their qualifications.
You also spoke briefly about doctors at different stages of their career. I mean, my experience is that people who've qualified 2 or 3 years before they became refugees often progress quite rapidly because their knowledge is up to date. It's more difficult with people who've been well established in specialties like paediatric neurosurgery, where it's very difficult to see how they're going to get on to the career ladder in the UK and progress. And as a consequence, this is very good news, we find a lot of people are very happy to retrain as GPs because the training is shorter, you don't have to move around so much, and you're not competing necessarily with people who are 10 or 20 years younger than you are.
The other major advantage in applying for GP training is that refugees are exempt from providing a CREST form to apply for GP training. So the CREST form is the Certificate of Readiness to Enter Specialty Training. It's a very long and involved form that needs to be filled in by a consultant who has worked with you recently for at least 3 months. And for most refugee doctors, they will be unable to get that completed without first going into a non-training post within the NHS. But as far as I know, the GP training programme is unique in the fact that refugees don't have to provide that form. They recognise that it's very difficult for them and they can evidence their competencies in other ways, which again makes GP training a really attractive option.
I think also networking is terribly important. You don't realise just how important your professional network is in actually progressing you through your career. And we've certainly been able to use our, I don't know whether people still use filofaxes, to identify people we knew in the past who are now consultant ophthalmologists, that we can actually just put in touch with one of our refugee doctors so that they can get a feel for where they might fit in and how they might progress.
Really interesting points you've highlighted there. And I wonder if I can come back to the issue of career stage of displaced doctors who are retraining. Molly, as a medical student, how have you found working with participants who may be coming from established mid-career or later career grades? Did it make you consider how you were interacting with them?
I think for us, what was quite a nice thing to discover is that the medical hierarchy is absolutely international. And we kind of really try to make sure that we approach all of our teaching with as much respect as we would have for any consultant, registrar, senior doctor, and that we really try to make sure that our participants don't feel like patronised or belittled. It's much more of a kind of an assistance as opposed to like a teacher-student relationship, which we think is incredibly important for us as medical students delivering the teaching. We kind of have a range of ages. Mostly the few men that we have tend to be younger, and then we have quite a large number of women who are slightly older, who have been here for longer but have had to sort out other things like childcare, etc., settling down before embarking on the journey and pre-qualifying.
It must be crucial to retain that equal peer-to-peer dynamic in order to make the sessions constructive for your participants. And I'd like to ask your thoughts on terminology and the language we're using to define refugee and displaced doctors. Are these definitions something important in your work and organisation, or how displaced doctors view themselves?
As a flat-out rule, we refer to our participants as participants or beneficiaries, and if needs be, we'll refer to people as members of the displaced doctor community. We very rarely use refugee and asylum seeker as a term, unless it's like for a specific purpose or to make it clear what we do in a situation like this, for example. When we first onboard people, we just ask them if they identify as displaced. We don't ask for any documentation, which I understand is a privilege in terms of the fact that our funding is not ring-fenced. And for us, that's incredibly important because we don't want our participants to feel like they are boxed into that category and that that is their identities. We want them to feel like doctors. We refer to them as Dr. X or Dr. Y in all of our communications with them. And for us, that's an incredibly important part of what we do.
One of the things that I advise when our students start working in the hospitals is to think carefully about how they introduce themselves to colleagues. Although at the moment with Ukraine, we're all very sympathetic towards refugees, there is in fact a lot of antagonism towards the refugee communities. So being labelled as a refugee isn't always helpful. So I encourage our doctors to introduce themselves as someone who's returning to medicine after a long break, or someone who trained overseas and has never worked in the UK before, as a way of just sort of being assessed in their own right, really. And then if they want to disclose about their past, then that's fine. But as a general rule, I don't question our refugee doctors about their backgrounds and pasts. If you're a refugee, you spent so much of your time giving accounts of yourselves to various bureaucrats and officials. And I think the whole thing is actually quite demeaning and actually quite re-traumatizing. So I'm always very happy and very moved, really, by the stories that people do share. But I think it's important to actually relate to people as they are in the here and now and where they're going to be in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have a similar ethos, really, at Reach. We do ask for proof of somebody's Home Office immigration status when they join us, but only as far as it relates to their permission to work and their future plans. It's really frustrating, obviously, as an asylum seeker. You don't automatically have permission to work. You can apply for it after you've been an asylum seeker for, I believe, 6 months at the moment, but that won't necessarily be granted. So it's important for us to know where somebody stands and where their immigration case is up to, so that we can help plan for that and perhaps support them to apply for permission to work and give them other ways that they can contribute to the community, maintain their medical knowledge and develop their confidence and prepare to return to work whenever they're able to do so. It's interesting, as you sort of alluded to, Alice, the situation globally is changing all the time, and refugees from different areas and different conflicts may be given different types of status. For example, a lot of the people who came to the UK from Afghanistan last year have been given a new status of evacuees, which is distinct from refugees, distinct from asylum seekers. And again, their entitlement to things like sources of funding and support is different to refugees and asylum seekers. And it can be quite difficult to navigate that and to advise our members on what support they can and can't access.
And another, just adding to that as well, a lot of female refugee and asylum seekers, well, refugees rather, are classed as economic migrants despite fleeing persecution. Especially like gender-based violence, it often is not recognised as a reason to seek asylum in the UK, which is partially why we have a slightly broader definition of displacement, because we have a lot of female participants and we recognise that actually the Home Office definitions of what means that you're in danger are actually incredibly narrow. We've put in a lot of effort to engage with the LGBTQ plus community recently, and a very similar issue is found there, where, I mean, a quick Google would see a very horrendous history of people from that community trying to seek asylum in this country and what they need to do to prove their danger and persecution. So I think it's quite important to have a broad definition when giving assistance.
Absolutely. And in the current landscape of war and conflict we're witnessing, this awareness may be important to refugee and displaced doctors who are just striving for stability and normality. But something that may come up as a block for this community is, how do refugee and asylum seeker doctors find out about your organisations or projects and support groups? Or how do you reach out to them?
I think the last time we audited our data, it seems that most people find us through Google searches or through word of mouth, and that they hear about us from colleagues. We do have links, though, for example, with the local job centre, and we get people signposted to us from there and from other refugee organisations, for example, Manchester and Merseyside Refugee Support Networks. Refugees and Mentors are all organisations helping refugees and displaced people back to work that are aware of REACH and similar organisations and can point people in our direction.
Yeah, I think very much the same thing. I just did a quick Google search before I came on, and you'll find that the BMA, the GMC, Royal College of Physicians, Surgeons and Obs and Gynae, if you put in refugee doctor followed by one of those colleges or organisation, then a page will come up which has got links through to the organisations around the country which work with refugee doctors. And in fact, the BMA is very helpful in that. We have a committee two or three times a year with lots of the refugee organisations facilitated by the BMA with the GMC present. And that's been a very useful forum for identifying problems like publicity and actually getting action taken to make sure that the information is available. But I'm always surprised actually how people do sometimes only discover us when they go on the PLAB course, whereas other people, you know, if they're part of a refugee community that includes doctors, then there will often be somebody who knows. But I certainly, when I was working as a GP, had a very depressed couple of refugee doctors, and I managed to connect them to Queen Mary University College London, which was doing a scheme at that time, and now they're well established as GPs in North London.
We have a slightly different approach. Just briefly, I don't think I explained this. How we work is we have different branches in universities across the country, like in the UK, and we work out of them very much like a student society kind of model, because it's quite easy to adopt and it's quite easy to then like implant into various areas of the country. Within those branches, we have our teaching team. We also have an outreach team. The outreach team's entire job is to engage with the local community and area, people in the local area, to find participants. So most of our outreach officers have very good working relationships with their local kind of main refugee organization support networks and whatnot. And then we also have a national outreach strategy as well, in which we will contact larger refugee and asylum seeker charities across the country in order to obtain participants. Then as a result of that, we then kind of have the class, you know, people finding out about through friends and word of mouth, etc. But I'd say we get a majority of our participants through our active outreach strategy. I don't think we're particularly high up the Google search yet, and we're still yet to be put on the BMA website despite our effort.
How many universities are you based out of at the moment?
We're in five. We're in Nottingham, Bristol, Birmingham, Leeds and Oxford, three of which we set up last year, and then Oxford we're setting up this year. And we're hoping to grow more this year now that we have the kind of structure really down. It's really relatively easy to reproduce now.
Something that you've all mentioned is the importance of digital telephony and internet access. We know refugees and asylum seekers need to stay in touch with family and friends through phone calls, use the internet to send emails or search web browsers to look for your organisations, for example, or other supporting refugee organisations. Is this something that your participants have been able to access easily?
We all had to transfer over to Zoom a couple of years ago, the Refugee Council was actually quite helpful in getting some of our doctors connected to the internet because some of them didn't have access. And as you say, internet access is essential. And since we've all been working from home on Zoom, it's become absolutely essential. And I think it's probably changed the way we work because we're less geographically constrained now. And we are used to working this way for some of the things that we used to do in the past. You can't really do mannequin practice on Zoom, but you can do other things.
It was really difficult. We had to do a lot of reassessing and scrambling around at the beginning of the pandemic to try and help our members get online so that they continue to access the classes. So we previously had funding that was set aside to support transport and travel fees, travel to the hospital for classes, in part paid by BMA charities. And what we've done is repurposed that to support data plans, internet access. And we've partnered with an organisation called Computer Aid, who provide refurbished laptops, headsets for charities and non-profit organisations. So they have provided us with a whole load of laptops so that now all of our members can get online and continue to access the learning.
We haven't had any particular difficulties with it, like in terms of having to provide anything for anyone. I think like local refugee organisations we found have always been fantastic in supporting our participants with getting things like laptops, etc. I think it's interesting what Stephen said about geographical constraints. Part of why we kind of set up the way we did is because we recognise that whilst there were absolutely incredible programmes like Reach, Building Bridges, Lincolnshire Refugee Dogs Project, they were, you had to live in those areas at the time to be able to access like the full capacity of their support. We actually have a couple of participants that got in contact with us after being in contact with other projects, but not actually being able to physically go. We've had so many participants ask like, how can I move to Salford? I was like, I'm not sure if I can help you with that. But and so that's partially why we are set up the way that we are, is because there is currently no national in-person project. We're not an in-person project. And I think that's something that I'm as a group, and I've certainly spoken to a number of people in the space about this, pressuring Health Education England, the GMC, etc., into making a more cohesive response to this, to supporting this group of people across the country, no matter where they're placed, because most of the time they have no choice in where they go, which feels quite unfair.
Thank you for highlighting that, Molly. It is helpful to note that Building Bridges, Phoenix Project and Reach all operate in England currently, but there are great projects being run out of devolved nations, which are linked in the description below. And this brings me on to my next question. How and why did you start working in this area? And how can interested GPs or healthcare professionals listening to this podcast get involved with volunteering or working for projects who support refugees?
Mine's not going to be the most intellectual of answers, I have to say. I went to a play when I was in second year called The Jungle. It was about Calais. It was very, very good. And it was very touching. And I was just kind of thought during it, oh, this would be a good idea to do. There's not much else to it. And then working with my co-founder, Johnny, and developing the idea into what it is obviously came a lot later. And I just really enjoy working with this community. I find it endlessly inspiring. I also love working with other medical students and kind of working together to develop something is really enjoyable and a really good learning experience for all of us as well.
And for anyone who's a member of a GP SOC who is listening and might be interested in setting up a branch of the Phoenix Project in their university, how would they go about doing it?
If you just give me an email, it's phoenixprojectoutreach@gmail.com. we're always happy to open new branches. We do have some kind of strategy as to where we want to set up, but any kind of enthusiastic people who want to get involved, we're always very, very open to. We are, one of our core aims is to assist the development of young people in medicine in a more like leadership roles, because at the end of the day, think projects like Reach and Building Bridges, etc., the big ones, only came out of people who had great leadership skills and organizational skills, which is not something you're typically taught early on in medicine, I find. So we're just trying to find a way to help people develop those skills and to learn about and understand from a community to kind of make the NHS a better place to work for everyone, to be honest.
So I also became involved with REACH initially as a medical student at Salford Royal some years ago. REACH used to run sort of drop-in communication skills practice sessions for medical students with the REACH members. And I attended those a few times and really enjoyed the experience. And then a few years later as a GP, I noticed an ad in the local CCG newsletter where REACH were calling for volunteers. So I did volunteer teaching for REACH for a year or two. And then a clinical tutor vacancy became available. So I applied. That's what I've been doing since. And I would say in terms of getting involved, there are, you know, there's loads of opportunity really for GPs and other doctors to get involved at REACH. You could volunteer teaching for us. We're also always looking for mentors. So when our members reach the end of their journey with REACH and they return to work, we try to match them up with a doctor, somebody actively working in the NHS, to check in maybe once a month, once every 2 months, and just provide guidance and support and coach and mentor them really as they embark upon their career. You could also possibly offer placements, you know, observational placements, similar to that you'd offer to a medical student. If somebody could come and join you in your practice for a day or a week, see how it works, gain exposure to NHS culture and general practice, then that would be really helpful. And other ways that people could help would be by employing refugees. You know, Stephen mentioned earlier the medical support worker placements that have been set up in hospitals around the country, but we're also currently in talks with local GP practices about setting up opportunities for things like phlebotomy, healthcare assistant work. We've had some of our doctors go into note summariser jobs. So, you know, not necessarily doctor vacancies, but if you have any other sort of clinical or allied work within your practice, consider refugee doctors, you know, because it's really valuable for them and they'd be an asset to the practice.
I'm very encouraged really to see that whether you're at the beginning, the middle or the end of your medical career, there's still something useful you can do in this area. I think one of the advantages of GPs is they don't tend to move around. And I think local continuity is really quite important in these projects. So just having somebody who will kind of pass the baton on and carry some of the wisdom is really important. I got involved because when I retired, a friend who was a psychotherapist told me I would miss talking to patients one-to-one. And why didn't I do what he did, which was to learn to teach English as a second language? And then when I tried to start doing that, I found there wasn't much of a market for medical English, but there were places where I could work, you know, my USB being medical English, medical communication. And most of the people who work with me are actually recently or longer ago retired GPs, many of whom have been trainers and course organisers and programme directors. And they've got absolutely the skills for teaching small groups or individuals how to communicate, how to organise explanations, how to negotiate with patients and with other members of the healthcare team. So I think you can get involved at any stage of your career, really. I'm just very impressed by people who are still having to study or earn a living who have time to do this.
Those are really inspiring stories, and I hope some people listening might be inspired to get in touch with the organisations, maybe closer to them, and get involved with the work being done in this area. As my last bonus question, I want to ask you, what are your hopes for the future?
I think as Molly said earlier, it would be really nice to see a more cohesive approach to the development of refugee and asylum seeking healthcare professionals, and a bit more networking really between the various organisations so that we're working together.
Yeah, and over the years we've made multiple attempts to try to get the NHS generally more engaged in this, but somehow they've always got so many other balls in the air that this always goes to the back of the queue. But I think that with the recruitment and retention issue at the moment, then it really is going to be very important for the NHS generally to make use of the people that we've got here in this country, who've got the knowledge and the skills and the attitudes and the commitment to actually make a contribution in the future. And it's quite interesting, actually, when I try to get help for my refugee doctors from specialists working in the NHS, how many of them are either themselves refugees or were people whose families were refugees a generation or so ago. So there are a lot of refugees within the medical community in the UK.
Absolutely. I would echo the stuff about having a cohesive response to this. I think that, you know, even if you were going to look at a completely financial perspective, it costs almost £250,000 to train a UK medical student. And I can tell you now, I will not be a hundredth of as good as most of our participants when I start in July. So like, it really, you know, even if you were just looking at it from that perspective, it makes absolute sense. I think for us, I mean, I suppose the ultimate aim of a charity is to never have to exist. But outside of that slightly lofty goal, I think expanding so that we have branches in most medical schools in the country would be great, so that we're kind of establishing a stream of people going into the workforce who are very knowledgeable about this issue and therefore can move, as they move into higher level positions, can then use that power to make change in the space across all, hopefully all areas of the country and specialties as well, and all areas of the medical hierarchy. I hope that our participants feel well supported, and I hope that that support continues to grow. And I also hope that we can work more with amazing organisations like Reach and Building Bridges so that we can develop ourselves into a better organisation.
And that brings us to the end of this podcast. A huge thanks to our guests for sharing their thoughts and experiences. And thank you for listening to Team GP Perspectives. Look out for the other episodes in this special series where displaced doctors share their journeys, and we'll talk to GPs with a special interest in migrant and vulnerable patient health needs. Check out the description below to find links to the projects and schemes discussed today, as well as related resources. And if you're enjoying these conversations, then please share them with a friend or tweet us at Team GP. That's all for now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.